we were going to talk about predestination and free will today, I think. Is that right?
Yes. Yes.
Okay. Predestination, free will, destiny, chance, randomness, a bigger plan, or individual choice. And I guess my kind of initial thought is that it feels like that humanity comes down on two different sides of this issue. And there are just some people who are really interested in, you know, they feel better if they can feel like there is a bigger plan at work. And there are other people who feel better if they can feel like they have choice that can really sway the way things go. And I think that cuts across religion, across atheism, across all kinds of different things. I don't know. What do you think?
Well, for me, it's not so much about what brings me comfort, but what makes the most sense to me. And because, I don't know, I don't expect to be comforted by my religion. I know that sounds probably really weird, but I know if I look at Christianity, it is not a like, oh yeah, this is the most comfortable lifestyle ever. No, it's not. And I mean, Christ, the whole story is gruesome and horrible. So right. It's, I don't expect comfort. But I do expect people to have integrity and to try to be kind to each other. But I know bad things happen, and I know chaos does its thing. So all that to be said, comfort is not a motivator for why I believe something necessarily.
Right.
But I do see a difference between comfort and evil, like discomfort and evil. I don't conflate the two.
Yeah.
I do think that pain and suffering and all that, I don't like it. And I think death is bad, but mm-hmm. at the same time, I have a hard time. I don't know. That's just where I am right now. Right. So, but anyway, what I see is more, if I'm going to believe in a creator that can create everything out of nothing or infinity out of whatever can, yeah. I mean, this is here. It really is a stretch for me to believe that all that stuff is now predestined in a certain order and that I'm expected to fall in line with whatever mm-hmm. has been predestined, that I have some, it's not that I have some obligation to just
right
to be a part of that, and that my religion is either do I choose to be a part of the order or not. And and the idea that the creator of all that stuff is down here is looking down and saying, then thinking like, and actually caring about my tiny, tiny choices, or even big choice. I don't know. There's just something that just seems to me, and I'm not saying everybody else, but for me, I have to kind of turn off my whole imagination and my whole, just everything I am, I have to turn it off in order to accept that mm-hmm. that the creator of the universe actually is sitting up there saying, oh guys, you can't do that. You know, just to me, that's just very wimpy. And I don't, like, I forget how I explained it to somebody, like just that idea that God can't abide with certain things. And, you know, I just think of, it's like, really, you've got the God up in heaven. It's like, oh, guys, I can't even, you know, yeah. just like, that's not the God that I'm like, I want to yeah. be subject to. Not saying there's anything inherently wrong with not being able to even, but that there, but I want my God to be able to. So anyway, I, and you know, in terms of who God is, of course, I've already talked about how my idea of God is very nebulous. So I'm not necessarily talking about, you know, the big guy up in the sky with a lightning bolt or whatever. So, but.
I'm a huge fan of the lightning bolt. I'm hoping there's a whole bag of lightning bolts ready to go.
Are you a smiter?
You know, I think I'm, what's the word for it? Like, I want to be, go against people's expectations of what I would be, you know. So I've always tried to tell people I'm a, you know, fundamentalist and all kinds of things like that, you know. And so I really like to focus on things like the wrath of God. And so because I have such a different view of it that, you know, the typical kind of write-off answer is like, oh, well, you just kind of want the easy stuff or whatever, you know? So I like to really, really dwell on issues like, wrath and punishment and all kinds of things like that, just to kind of be perverse a little bit. So we should definitely talk about that. But yeah, I have a you go ahead.
Oh. How come you always defer? So anyway, there's the whole wrath thing. Is that something you want to get back to later, or do you want to talk
about? Let's come back to it later, because I want to make some comparisons that I think maybe are typical to miss here. And so let's just say right off, like, so you and I'm afraid we might be a little biased on the subject of like predestination versus free will, because I think that the Church of Christ, which both of us come from, is pretty heavy on the free will side of things.
It is, but there are definitely certain traditions that lean towards more Calvinistic thought, even though you don't say that word, but that it definitely, and I have noticed, and especially the congregation that I just came from, definitely has some heavy Calvinistic tendencies. And again, there's nothing inherently wrong with that, but I was surprised. I am surprised.
So I'm you know, I've been thinking about this in a lot of different ways, because, you know, I'll be in some panel discussions between, you know, where I'm on the panel and there might be somebody else, and then there's kind of a hardcore Calvinist person, and I'm friends with some Calvinists, and, you know, like, they're great people, but, you know, when they communicate, when they talk about what their theology means to them, you know, to me, I'm hearing it and I'm saying, that sounds terrible, right? But to them, it's very comforting. It was a relief to find this theology. You know, like it convinces them of the goodness of God in a way that other things can't. And I, you know, in trying to, because I try to understand, you know, the people who have different viewpoints than I do. I try to respect those viewpoints and to understand where they're coming from. And I've really kind of developed a notion that this is just like a very different personality type. And I feel like this is true in just the normal transhumanist kind of community as well. In the transhumanist discussion, there are two different kinds of transhumanists, typically. Some who identify more as singularitarians, and some who identify more as transhumanists. And I think the difference is between people who think that there is a plan that's working itself out versus people who think that it's really important that we make certain decisions or things could go really badly. And are you familiar with the kind of distinction I'm talking about, the singularitarian versus transhumanist?
Yes, one is one seems to be more defensive or trying to make something not happen, and the other's trying to make something happen. It almost,
sometimes true. The singularitarians are typically people who believe that because of the exponential advance of computing power, that we are inevitably headed towards a singularity, right? And so there may be good things about that. There probably are good things about that. There may be bad things about that. And our role is to figure out how we react to this inevitable development, basically. And then people who don't necessarily identify as singularitarians would be, and just would identify as transhumanists, maybe say, you know, I don't know if the singularity is going to happen or not, but here's the things we should do to make the world better, right? And so, yeah, a lot of singularitarians are more concerned about avoiding the consequences of bad AI or something like that, because they think that's a huge threat that's basically inevitably headed our way. but yeah, I think to me that seems like a similar difference. You know, the singularitarians are kind of Calvinists, in that they see this future inevitably coming, and there's a lot of bad things in that future, versus maybe the non-singularitarian transhumanists who are much more about, like, how do we change the world? What choices can we make to make sure that things, you know, get better?
Right. And I mean, there are definitely advantages to both sides, and they're not exclusive, of course,
yeah,
either. So,
yeah.
And that's interesting in terms, because there are so many things about predestination that mm-hmm. seems to be totally exclusive of free will. How can you,
right?
If you're not even speaking the same language, if you're not even expecting the same things or the same outcomes, or, you know, how do you mm-hmm. combine your efforts? How do you work together?
Yeah.
And that's, yeah, I like the idea that there are different doctrines in transhumanism that mm-hmm. you definitely have. And then it seems like that the single, man, I can't say it.
Yeah, it's a hard word.
Singularitarians are more, I would say, church-centric. If you're making that analogy.
Yeah.
Whereas the broader collective of transhumanists are more gospel-centric. Again, if you're going to make that comparison.
I like it.
And I'm not saying one is inherently better than the other. I'm just saying there is definitely a message versus a culture war or whatever. So
that's interesting, huh?
Well, I could be totally wrong, but that's my takeaway.
That's an interesting comparison. I think this, you know, this also appears in just kind of atheist discussion as well. Sam Harris has, I think, a book basically trying to debunk the idea of free will. And so he's, you know, he's writing from an atheist perspective, trying to convince people that they don't have free will. And presumably, you know, he thinks that's a good thing to do. You know, presumably he thinks that if people believe they don't have free will, they'll be better off. And you know, that kind of counter to a lot of the atheists that I read growing up, who were, you know, they were interested in being atheists so they could increase their free will, right? So without a God to kind of control things, they had the freedom to, you know, to do anything, right? Or not necessarily personally, but as a society, we could, you know, we could do all kinds of different things because we weren't having to be, you know, subject to the will of God. So I think in atheism, there seems to be both sides of that as well, you know? So I don't know. I think that's a really, really interesting thing, you know, to ask, well, what is it that people are looking for, or what is it that works for people about one thing versus the other? And
well, so for you,
mm-hmm.
or sorry, you want to
no.
go on? Sorry. So for you, are you more of a free will person or a?
Yeah, I'm definitely more of a free will person, but it's interesting that, you know, on kind of what we've talked about, you know, moving through your life, how you change, I've become more of a free will person over time. And I'm not sure what to think about that, because I used to really get a lot out of the fact that there might be some things that were predetermined, even if, you know, but giving us a lot of freedom, you know, but there might be some things that were predetermined. And now, like, that makes me feel a little bit claustrophobic. So, like, even if there's anything that's predetermined, and I'm not sure where that's coming from. I'm not sure what that that difference is. But you had mentioned, you know, this idea of, like, what makes you comfortable. And I wonder if it's actually deeper than that, though, not just kind of what makes people comfortable, but what makes people feel like they are empowered to act.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, you know, free will is what empowers you to act. Like, that idea, you know, believing you have free will is what gives you the ability to do something that, you know, that is somewhat free. And not having a sense of free will kind of takes that away. But I don't think that's true for everybody.
Right. And also, I know growing up, what I've always heard was that free will was kind of a punishment, that God's like, oh, you all do your own thing. And that actually heaven was a place where we'd all be the same and we'd all be in communion with God, and that free will would be taken away. And that was the ideal. That's what God wanted all along. But we were so that free will was, to me, was always this idea of a separation from God. And I, as a strong-willed child, definitely struggled with that, because I don't know if I got that I don't know if I really picked that up from my parents or just my overall faith community or what, but there are books that are definitely, I think it is more just an American culture, a fundamentalist culture type thing, because even though we grew up in the Churches of Christ, there is there is some overlap in some of the traditions that will overlap with overall evangelical or fundamentalist culture.
Yeah.
And a lot of that has been heavily swayed by, especially in parenting books like Dr. Dodson and Dobson. I can't say right.
Yeah.
You know who I'm talking about. Focus on the Family Guy.
Yeah.
So he wrote The Strong-Willed Child, and that book, I remember reading it as a teenager and thinking, oh, this is off. That's me. That was so me as a kid. And like, my life would have been so much different if this idea hadn't been, you know, if the idea that there was something wrong with me, that I had, there was something wrong with my spirit, that I was in rebellion with God and I needed that to be, you know. And it's not that my parents necessarily picked up on that, but I think it's just overall culture. So teachers and coaches and people like that there were definitely people who saw who I was, which I wasn't a bad kid. I really wasn't. And I'm not just saying that, but I definitely could be obnoxious and out of control and stuff like that. But I wasn't, you know, I wasn't, you know, when you think of the bad kids, not that I think there is such thing as a bad kid, but you know what I mean? Like, and so I always feel very defensive whenever I hear anything about that there is some, we need to break our will and to God's will instead. Because to me, I'm like, that's how I was, for whatever reason, this is who I am and this is how I came to be. And what is wrong with that? You know, why would I? And I spent so long trying to undo everything I was and everything that I had become, because I was just so convicted that was wrong. And, but okay, I was 90% convicted, but there was always that little 10% that was like, no, this can't be true. This cannot be. And of course that little part was the part that volcano erupted and here I am. So we've got, so there is, I guess Dr. Dobson is right. I am rebellious and I should have had that 10%. totally wiped out of me, because it is. But the idea that there is a pattern, or there is an idea that there is something in humanity, inherent in humanity, that needs to be wiped out or broken.
Yeah.
And that needs to be broken first. And then once you realize you're broken because you need to break it, mm-hmm. then Jesus comes in and fixes it. Mm. And that seems to be the whole premise, is that you have to be broken first before you can be saved, because what's the point? Mm. And then of course there's
got to get the bad news before the good news, right?
Yeah. But that if you think that you're not broken, that's just because you have a strong will, and you're not bowing down to God's will. And there is just always something that seemed very circular and forced about that to me, that why would I break something that was okay? And mm-hmm. why I had to first convince myself that I wasn't good enough in order to be a Christian. And that always really, really bothered me. Hmm. I mean, obviously that sounds, but a lot of people are comforted by that. And maybe they've had really, really rough lives where they were already broken, and this brought them peace. And we've talked about that in the past, but what about those people who are never going to think that they're broken?
Right.
And are never going to truly, truly believe it. And
My path, and when I'm trying to compare it to yours, like, it weaves and winds like a lot of the same territory, but different. I think I was Dobson's whatever it was, a weak-willed child, or you know, whatever. I was always trying to please authority figures and stuff like that. And I didn't become otherwise until I got older. I remember I found a book, you know, my parents always had a huge kind of personal library that they carried around with them. And so I read all those books, and they were from lots of different perspectives. And I found a book one time that was talking about, you know, raising children. And, it was, telling people to break, you know, to break their child's will, you know, and I was horrified, you know, because this was such an abhorrent idea, so counter to everything that I understood about life, and to, you know, the way my parents, you know, approached things. You know, my parents basically were like, you know, you know, kids are just naturally good. You know, you just kind of let them do what they need to do, and then they'll turn out okay, basically, you know. Mm-hmm. And maybe not when they get a little bit older, but, you know, babies are just, you know, great. You know, they can do nothing wrong. And so that was the way that I was, you know, that I grew up, just thinking that, oh, the best thing to do is just to kind of like free range, you know? And so my parents, we were homeschooled in a very, very unstructured way. We were basically, you know, when we were in West Virginia growing up, we just spent all day out in the woods, you know, eventually we'd make our way home, you know, and that was how I spent a lot of time. And so this idea that, you know, you need to kind of impose some kind of structure on somebody in order to make them okay, that never worked with me at all.
Right. And it's funny, because my parents were very similar in theory, but I went to public school. But mm-hmm. my parents were always, they always said, this is a supplement. You know, I think I've brought this up before. You know, this is a supplement. Your real education is what you do on your free time, and whatever you choose to do. And that's your education, and that's where you're going to grow and become who you are. And I think a lot of that had to do with, at the time, we lived in Virginia, and homeschool laws were just insane. Like, it would have been way too much trouble anyway. But at the same time, I enjoyed school. I got a lot out of it. I made a lot of interesting connections, and I have a perspective that I wouldn't have had otherwise.
Right.
So I'm grateful for that. But there was always this, it was very interesting because I went to public school and then I was part of this faith community that was very, very much, you know, this is black and white. This is how the world works. And yet my parents themselves were not like that. And I think, you know, they struggled. I mean, I know they struggled inside their faith community as well. And they're not a part of it anymore. But yeah, none of us. No, I think my sister still is. But yeah. So my parents definitely put us on this path, so to speak, that you figure out life for yourself, and we're not going to be here to tell you what to do or tell you what to learn. We're mm-hmm. not going to make sure you do all your homework. Like, my parents never made me do my homework after a certain, you know, they're like, this is your deal. If you get an F, then that's your F. That they didn't feel any responsibility for that at all. Like, when I failed chemistry when I was 17, they had the summer school offering and my mom's like, you want the A, you have to pay for it. So I had to pay for my own summer school and I made the A, but she's like, I'm not paying because you failed, like, that, you know? Right. So, but I got the A and I was okay. But yeah, so there was definitely that idea that we're here to support you and meet your basic needs, but we're not going to tell you, mm-hmm. we're not going to tell you what your path should look like. Mm-hmm. And definitely if there were red flags, they would say, hey, you know, this looks like,
right,
maybe this isn't for you or whatever. But for the most part, yeah, very, very much, very, if not supportive, like, you know, they weren't going to be like, oh yes, I'm going to buy all your equipment or whatever. But right. But in terms of ideas, whatever I wanted to do, they're like, yeah, if you want to do it, but you have to make it happen. So, mm-hmm. so yeah. So that was definitely my idea. I think my ideas of God are probably definitely mm-hmm. shaped by my ideas of how my parents parented.
Right.
I think that's kind of how this works.
Yeah.
And when we think of, you know, what's in charge or what created us, what that, I mean, that's the first thing we're going to look towards is who is our creator. My parents, you know? So, So there was definitely this idea of, this is the way the world works. You know, there's certain things, you follow certain laws because this is how you interact with human beings in our society. But also inside of that, you have free range to be whoever mm-hmm. you need to be.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah, I think, my parents basically had the idea of like, oh, well, you need to have good character. And otherwise, you know, it's pretty open-ended. Right. And I do think it's good to compare with, you know, how you react to the way you were raised, because I think that is, you know, how we, when we think about like the problem of evil and so forth, how could God create a world that allows such pain and suffering if they're, you know, if God is loving, that kind of thing. We can also pose that same challenge to our parents. Like, how could they have brought us into the world knowing that so much suffering was possible, but almost definitely would happen, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And of course, you know, everybody decided that was still worthwhile, right? Everybody's parents decided that, you know, it's still worth it bringing humans into the world, even though they're going to suffer. And the way that they think through that, and the way that we think through that, is really, I think, shows us a lot about how humanity works. Because if it's, you know, if somebody, you know, processes that by saying, okay, well, you know, it's a world of suffering, but we're going to create this plan and that's going to help the person get through it. And that's going to be, you know, that's going to be the one path that saves them from ever having any kind of trouble. Or, you know, we're going to equip them as best we can, but we're going to trust that they kind of, you know, find a pretty good way in the world. And even if it goes pretty badly, it's still worthwhile. You know, like, those are different approaches that people take, I think. And I'm not a parent, so I don't, you know, I'm just kind of hypothesizing my way through this. But I think, you know, I think we have very different senses of how you account for the fact that life has a lot of suffering to it.
Right. And And I think one thing that my parents really pushed for, and that I do as well in my own parenting, is that part of our responsibility, part of our reason for trying to make ourselves better, is so that not only so we can avoid the pain, but definitely so we can look around and see who is suffering and be strong enough to be able to help other people.
Right.
And that's what I, at least, I probably say that at least 10 times a week, that, you know, whenever they complain about, oh, why do I have to do chores, or why, you know, all the things that we all, and, you know, we still complain about. I don't like doing
chores. Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, like, but just this idea of why is that so important? Why do I have to brush my teeth? Why do I have to do this? Like, what is the grand overarching idea of maintaining my existence? Like, why is that such a, why, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, of course they're little kids, but they're all already asking that question.
Yeah.
When they're like 2 years old, why? That's like the first thing they, thing they say. So, but this idea is, why is it so important for you to be a strong person? Why, when you look around, especially when they look around them and they see other grownups or kids that aren't necessarily, don't have stable lives and aren't necessarily, that are definitely struggling in a lot of areas. And they're like, well, how come they can make these choices? And I have to be this, you know, this upright person of integrity. How come, you know? And I tell them, because, you know, yes, of course, at the end of the day, you get to choose whoever you want to become. And that's, you know, that's, I'm not going to pretend that I can actually, I actually can, they have to make their own choices ultimately. And that I tell them that you have to make sure that you're strong and you're the best person you can be, so that you have, you're looking out for those people that are struggling, and we all have to help each other out. Mm-hmm. And one day you're going to be the one who's struggling, and there's going to be somebody who's stronger in another area, and they're going to help carry you. And that's just the way the world works. And that's kind of how, so there is this idea, of course, that I have, that there is some kind of structure that holds us all together, and that we can't really escape that. And that, I know what Martin Luther King Jr. is like, the web of mutuality, that we're all connected and all of our choices affect each other. And so I do operate according to that understanding. Yeah. So in a way, I definitely have a predestination type, or at least a destiny, or not, I don't even want to say destiny, because I don't have any idea of where it's going to end up, but just the idea that there is something external that is stable, and that I cannot disconnect myself from.
Right.
That, and I mean, I could even say, well, what if I shot myself into space and I lived, you know, on a planet? But I'm still the little thing, like the butterfly effect. You know, anything that I do is going to affect some other molecule in the universe. So that I cannot escape that. Mm-hmm. And that when it comes down to that, it's not even just physical, the laws of physics. It is definitely, there's a metaphysical aspect to that we're all connected.
Yeah, I think so. I have a kind of framework for thinking about what you're just describing, which is comes from game theory, and game theory, you know, is basically a branch of mathematics which tries to analyze what are the best strategies given certain, you know, situations. And so the most common one that people are familiar with is the prisoner's dilemma, where, you know, you have two people, and, you know, the basic premise is, are you going to betray the other person, or are they going to betray you? And if both of you, you know, don't betray each other, then you both win, but you don't know if the other person's going to betray you or not. And so, you know, it's this question of, do you trust even though somebody could take advantage of you, or do you take advantage of someone but remove the basis for trust, right? And so game theory analyzes that, and if you have just one exchange, like if it's just you pop into existence, I pop into existence, and then the question is, like, do you betray the other person? then you might be better off by betraying them. But if you have two exchanges, then the situation changes a little bit. If you have three, four, five, the more exchanges you're going to have, the more interactions you're going to have with this person, then the more it becomes necessary not to betray them, but to actually start off with trust and to work towards trust.
Right.
And so if we just can extrapolate that, if you have an infinite number of exchanges in the future, infinite expected exchanges, then basically your interests and the other person's interests are exactly the same. And so this is, you know, if you live in a society, this is kind of how you operate, is that you are living in a world with a nearly infinite number of future exchanges with everyone in it. And it's only because our lifespans are fairly short that we don't feel this as strongly as we might. But ethics is basically just the application of that. You know, I might run into you a million more times. Therefore, I should treat you well, because your future well-being and my future well-being are actually exactly the same thing at a certain distance. Does that make sense? And I'm kind of abstract.
Yeah, and that definitely has a lot to do with like Zen Buddhism, the idea that when you hurt hurt others, you hurt yourself. So why would you ever choose to hurt anybody else?
Right.
And of course that also is reflected in Christianity, love your neighbor as yourself and all that.
Right.
But it's funny that you said that we may not feel this idea that we're deeply connected with everybody else as strongly. And yet I inside me, something just kind of not screamed, but just like yelped. It's like, because I do feel that super strongly. And I know it's something that I don't know. I every so often I meet other people who do feel that very strongly. And then it's such a relief because otherwise it's only recently that I've started to feel that or just be aware of it. And to the point where, and I know everybody goes through those phases where you have this enlightenment and then you look around, you're like, why does not, what's wrong with everybody else? Like, why don't you, I don't know. And I know one of those big gateway books out of fundamentalism is Blue Like Jazz. I'm sure.
Yeah.
I'm sure you've read it, of course. Yeah. So anyway, I mean,
I was in the movie.
Yeah, I know. I was going to say, do you want me to bring that up? Yes. Yes. You're totally starring in the movie.
All right. Starring in the movie.
But it was funny because when I watched that movie, I didn't know that you were in it at the time. And I found out later. And so it's like the scene and I'm like, what? Wait, that's what in the world? And then there's other people there too that I know. And I can't remember who all.
Yeah.
But it was just really funny to see that. But anyway, I mean, it was great. Is great, but it was very disorienting.
Yeah, it's a funny scene, and it's like I'm in it for like a split second, you know.
It's a weird scene too.
Yeah,
it's really bizarre. But anyway, but yeah, good job. Good job. But anyway, in the book, Don Miller says he like goes through this. He went through this phase where he was acutely aware of the fact that he was alive. And and that he would just be walking down the street and just be like overcome with that sense of vitality and just whip his head around like, I'm alive, alive, and just look around at everybody else. And they're just going about their business. And he's like, why are they not affected by this? Like, you know, I know that's just, and of course it passed or, you know, he acclimated to the idea. But I think that's, I know what that is. I know what that feels like. I remember being at the DMV once, and I know this sounds like the worst. Like, everybody's like, oh, I was at the DMV. And it was right when I had my, like, little transition out of, you know, that 10% that kind of was erupting and was like, no, this is my life, and there's more to this. And anyway, and I remember just looking around and actually, and I'm not a super, like, feely type person, and I actually, like, had tears in my eyes because I was like, all these people, I'll never know them, and that they all have their own lives, and they're like, yeah. And here we are all standing in the exact same place, doing the exact same thing for the exact same purpose, so we all can drive on the same roads, and none of us care about each other. And that bothered me so much. Yeah. But at the same time, I'm not going to go up and like talk to everybody either.
Yeah.
But yeah, everybody goes out of their way to avoid eye contact and to almost be ugly, because you know it's the DMV and you're supposed to be. So that's the rule, yeah. Is you have to be a jerk at the DMV. So anyway, but yeah, that interconnectedness is so any, yeah, I do feel that very, very deeply, and it comes in waves. Right now I'm at a very meh place in that right now, but I'm sure it'll peak again.
Well, you know, I had a similar thing for a couple of years. I had what I think of as my mystical phase, and basically where I was, I would stand in a Taco Bell and be, I would look at the ceiling and I would say, what depth of complexity and nuance is happening here? And it was, you know, it was just, the world was effervescent, you know, to me. And I could just look at these surfaces, you know, and I would see like, a wooden table. And of course, this is a constructed wooden table, but the underlying grain of it was, you know, something that came from the universe, right? We didn't design it that way. It was just there. Or I would even, you know, or even like look at a metal table, which we did, you know, pretty much, all the grain of that we put into it. And yet there are chemicals, there are molecules there that are moving in a way that is unpredicted and, you know, just this chaotic kind of beautiful, order and symmetry that's going on that is just baked into the universe that we didn't have to put into anything. And I would just be kind of like enraptured by the complexity and depth of everything I was seeing around me in these, you know, dumb things, you know, these things that,
right.
I had that for a while and then it went away. And now I'm definitely not in that, you know, that frame of mind. And it's weird because I've always been very analytical, and I'm just as analytical before and after and during, as any other time. But I had that kind of, you know, semi-mystical perception for a while. And people who knew me were like, you know, I would sort of describe it and they were like, this does not sound like you, you know, this does not sound like the way that they would think I would, you know, kind of process the world. So yeah, we have those kinds of things and sometimes we see that. And to your point, you know, like I am a very probably overly empathetic person. So, you know, I feel any kind of hurt that I might inflict on somebody else, in a pretty strong way. But, you know, I think, you know, that's, you know, at different levels for different people and, you know, comes and goes, for individuals. But I think that, you know, from the analytical perspective, when we feel that deep empathy for someone, what we're experiencing is the idea that, you know, their interest and our interest are completely the same, that their well-being and our well-being are completely the same. And that's from a, you know, just a kind of analytical, somewhat cynical view here. That's only true if we all lived forever. If we all lived for an infinite amount of time and then interacted with each other for infinite times, then that would be true. So for us to feel that it's true is to sort of leap towards infinity, right? It's to sort of imagine an infinite future with someone. And right. I think that's why, even though, you know, I think that's why religion with its idea of some kind of infinite attached to people, and ethics, and empathy and so forth have gone hand in hand so much, because it's precisely when we start to imagine, you know, an eternity spent with someone that we can really grasp in a deep way the idea of of, you know, their interest and our interest being exactly the same.
Right. And so then you have this huge paradox, because you have free will.
Yep.
And that's what drives you. That is your motivator. And yet what it motivates you towards is this idea that you are me and I am you, and we are we together.
Anyways, yeah, yeah.
Sorry. So I was like, wait, that's a Beatles song.
Yeah.
I didn't even do that on
my I am the Walrus. Anyway, yeah.
Yes, yes. I think, man, I just had deja vu because I'm almost positive that we
already did that same conversation. Probably so. Probably so.
But anyway.
Yes.
So the idea, that what happens, because when I think of the idea of predestination, or that I have to subscribe myself to a certain ideal, or that I have no choice in it, that I'm just, you know, I'm a pawn in this game, or whatever people say, that is very counterintuitive, because that is not my goal. My goal is not to fall in line with something yet. And so I always have this idea of have you seen Ghostbusters, the original?
Yeah.
Ghostbusters. Mm-hmm. Okay, so you know there's the idea when Sigourney Weaver is basically she's inhabited by Satan, basically, and Bill Murray's trying to talk to her, and she's like, hey, Dana, and she's like, there is no Dana, there's only Zool. And so there's this idea that oftentimes when I talk to people who do subscribe to Tulip, to the you know, the points of Calvinism, it's almost always, I feel like I'm talking to a Bible or a cut and paste conversation with John Calvin or John Piper or somebody. I very rarely get actual ideas of that human being.
Right.
And it always is very, like, I feel like that. I'm like, am I talking to you or am I talking to Zool? Like, what's going on here? But yet I realize that the reason that they are emptying themselves and filling it with this is not necessarily because that they're doing it for the same reasons that I'm not, that I'm rejecting it, is that for me, the way I connect with other people is not to filter it. And for them to connect with other people is to make sure that everybody is on the same page and we're all speaking the same language.
Yeah.
And, it's been really hard because, you know, I've gone through that. I grew up very, very, you know, legalistic, that this is the way. And I was kind of a jerk about it. And, you know, I said I was a good kid, but I was not really a nice teenager. So, as I was in my 20s, I started to be a little more, I tried to follow this, you know, I was like, okay, take the mote out of my own eye. And then I was very, very strict with myself. And then now I'm on the other end of that, where I was so strict with myself that I got to the point with, oh, wait, actually, it's not just about me. It's about all this other stuff. So that's what, you know, now I'm way back in nebulous land, and I'm way back to where I was when I was a, you know, like I said, my transition to being a jerk, being a jerk mode was around 17. So 16 was like, that was my peak. I peaked at 16. So, and it all went down there.
Yeah.
But just this idea that, just because somebody is speaking somebody else's words and finds comfort in that, that doesn't necessarily mean that they aren't human, or that they're just robots, or that they're just following a script out of fear, that they are doing it because that is how they want to connect to other people.
Yeah.
I'm trying to learn how to speak that language, because I do think it's important. But at the same time, like you said, it really depends on how often I have these interactions with people. And so if it's somebody that I'm going to have to live with, or I'm related to, or somebody that's my, you know, just somebody I'm going to be with a lot, then that it does become more important. But I don't know. It's hard.
Yeah, I think so. There's this concept in Christian theology that I think is significant, and it kind of bridges some of this in an interesting way, which is the idea that as we become more connected, we become more individual, and so this is, you know, counter to the Borg or counter to we all head off in different directions in the universe, never to reconnect. The idea that we can grow increasingly interconnected and that enhances our individuality rather than suppresses it. And I think you can, you know, you could say in some ways the internet does that. You know, we become increasingly interconnected, but it also enables a lot more extremes to come out, you know, which might be a bad thing or a good thing. But in some ways it takes us away from being kind of the gray middle average and accelerates the things that are kind of individual about us. And I think C.S. Lewis kind of dwells on this idea a little bit. Chardin, he talks about it. It's a big thing in Phenomenon of Man that as the world grows increasingly interconnected, in the Christian vision, it's not moving towards, you know, what he would call pantheism. It's where everything's just kind of the same, or just kind of an expression of the same thing, but rather it's moving towards this greater individuality, and so the free will is accelerated by our interconnection with others, not dampened from that. And I think that's a thing that we could, you know, that idea could be come in really handy as we look at technological acceleration as well.
Right. And that is a fantastic way to see things, especially if you are somebody who sees free will as a gift of God or whatever, you know, but I always come back to, what about the people who see free will as
a punishment,
as against the will of God, or you know, that you're free, you are given free will to see if you will subject yourself, like if you use that free will to subject yourself to God's will. And of course, all of us then we're like, well, what is God's will? And that's where you get everybody fighting. So there's this idea that when we see each other and when we interconnect and when we touch each other's lives, the more we connect, the more we enhance our individualism, because we advocate for each other, because we care about each other. And that's, for me, that's why separation of church and state is so important. That's a big thing for me. And I know you're not a political person. And that's one thing that my parents did raise me to be, was I was heavily encouraged to be involved in every single school politics thing. I had every office. I ran every single year from third grade through 12th grade, and I didn't always win, but yeah, I ran. It was just something, and it wasn't that my parents were like, you have to do this. It was just like, it didn't make sense not to. Like, I had no reason not to do it. It was like, well, that's what you do. If you want to see things happen, you have to be the one that makes it happen. You don't wait around for somebody else to do it. So there is that. I've always had that sense of, well, I cannot say the government or society did that, because I'm like, well, that's me. I am the government. I am society. So what am I doing about that? So there is that strong sense of, and that's one thing that I am passionate about, is separation of church and state. And because it's not that I'm trying to take God out of school, or, you know, like, I'm not trying to remove God from anything. I'm trying to protect everybody's right to have what they need to have, down to whether I agree with your beliefs or not. The fact is that your beliefs are sacred and they're important, and you have a right to worship freely, as long as you're not hurting anybody, of course. But that calls us to do some really seemingly counterintuitive things. Like, I might support somebody who believes something that I could never believe. But that in and of itself is a reflection of what I believe, is to support and advocate for that person's right. And that's a really wacky thing for a lot of people. That's why, you know, that it's a hard thing to reconcile if you are definitely black and white one way or the other.
Yeah, but I'm totally with you, and you know, I've always understood Christianity in that way. One of the things that I've said before is Christianity is a platform, meaning it's not a closed system. It's not designed to create a closed society or closed environment where we all do things in a certain way. It's designed to enable a bigger and more diverse environment. And, you know, and this is the thing that I think, where, you know, my kind of resolution to this tension between, predestination and free will is that it is good for us to have, you know, to work for some definite things, to have definite plans. But the plans and the definite things that we should, always be working for is to create more space for others, to create more free will. And I think that, you know, this is how I see God working, is to, you know, God does definite things. God might very well, you know, kind of lay his foot down or whatever to stop certain things from happening, but it's only to create more space for other things. And you can kind of see this through something like the Tower of Babel, which is, you know, a story where God sees people basically turning themselves into this hierarchical society that's very top heavy in terms of power. And God introduces diversity to keep things moving and basically sends people, you know, keeps people going, keeps people exploring. But I think, you know, the way that I would look at this is around the concept of infinite games, which we've talked about before, I think. Like, finite games you play to win, infinite games you play to keep playing. And the only real rules of an infinite game are the things that keep the game going, right? You just got to make sure that that the game doesn't end, that people aren't excluded from the game permanently. You know, and so that requires some things. You know, it requires we not blow each other up with nuclear weapons. It requires, you know, some kind of rules around how we do society so we can all cooperate and work together. But those are structural rules. They're platform rules to enable us to make bigger and more diverse and more interesting choices.
Right. And there are definitely those platform rules, but there's also this sense where there's this idea of, oh, well, we have to, like, it's our job to not, I don't believe this, but to go out of our way to introduce chaos in order to make the world different. Like, oh, our job is to turn the world upside down. Well, let's dump everything out. And in a sense that is what happens, but it's not like that. That's not the end game. It's not like there's this group of people who are like, we're going to dump things out and just to keep everybody moving. So,
right.
So that the world is a fit place. And I think that's, I was reading about this. What was it? Oh, the idea of catfishing,
like, yeah,
on the internet. And I was like, where did that name come from? I was trying to put it together in my head. I was like, I have to look this up because I couldn't figure it out. But the idea was that when people would ship big crates of fish, like cod, across big seas, it would always end up at the other end just a mess of dead fish flesh because they were just hanging out. There wasn't anything that they didn't have any reason to move or anything. They just kind of just stayed there and then they died. But when they would put some catfish into the box with the cod, it kept them moving. It kept them alive. It gave them a sense of purpose. And then everybody, all the fish survived. So,
wow.
Yeah. So this idea of catfish, the people that are, you know, basically trolls, or not even necessarily trolls, but just people who are out there whose sole purpose is to keep you on your toes and make you question everything.
Yeah.
Is that maybe a healthy thing for our society? But for me, I am definitely opposed to the idea that there should be any orchestrated,
right?
Like, okay, yeah, like if this is a communist society, like there would be people who were designated catfishers to keep everybody in line, you know. And that just seems super, super wrong to me. But
yeah.
But I do think that there is an organic element to that, that there are always going to be those people who are going to be the person who's going to jump in the tank of you know, people who are comfortable,
yeah,
and they're going to mess everything up. And, mm-hmm, and then, you know, they get to where they need to be and maybe that fish goes and does something else. And they're all like, wait, what just happened here? You know? And, I think that's a good thing. And that's where I come back to, it's not comfortable though. It's,
yeah,
not comfortable to be on your toes all the time. And that's why I think there's a time and place where it doesn't need to be all the time,
yeah,
but at the same time, I am defensive about it because I do feel like I am that type of person, and not on purpose, but I do find myself in, I want to say fish out of water, but that doesn't work with what we're talking about. But anyway, but I find myself in places where I don't fit in, and yet, I'm not doing it. It's not like, hey, what can I do today to mess up the world? It's just where I find myself for whatever reason. And it's always interesting. And
you know, that makes me think of, you know, whenever you talk about something like, can we be peaceful people, you know, things like that, when people start having discussions about pacifists versus, you know, warmongers and things like that. There's always the kind of, doves and hawks, sort of analogy, or, you know, which is like, okay, if you had a society of perfect people, then you could have a peaceful world and nobody would ever have to do anything harmful to each other. But it's a really unstable society because you can always have, you know, a wolf or a hawk that comes in and then can take advantage of everybody because you're not prepared, right? You're not prepared for an aggressor to come into your community. And so, you know, a lot of people have looked at that kind of thing as a bad thing, that you would be destabilized by such forces. But I think, in a lot of ways, like that is, the fact that that's the situation, the fact that there is a lot of randomness in nature that introduces, you know, you never know when a sociopath will come into your community. And that in actually provokes you to, you know, create a stronger community. You have to do that, you know, have to create stronger bonds of trust and so forth in order to kind of overcome that, those kind of random threats. And I guess my point is that if you look at it as trying to, like, how do we create a perfect world, you know, that's static and, you know, create the perfect system for all time, then none of these options work very well. But if you look at it as like, we're trying to have a community that continues to grow and change and evolve, and, you know, we'll see where we end up, then actually that kind of destabilizing force, serves a really useful purpose. And maybe that's not bad at all. And I think that's where so much of our attempt at, you know, thinking through how we want to be a society or how we want to do ethics or how we want to do philosophy or whatever fails, because we assume that we need to figure out a perfect pattern or perfect plan that will work for all time, instead of assuming that maybe we're trying to get the structure that is most conducive to open-ended growth.
Right. And I was just having this conversation last night about our kids go to a school that is very, very open-ended. I can't remember if I've talked about it here before, but it's Sudbury Valley Model School, if anybody wants to look that up. But it's where basically there's no curriculum, there's no set schedule, that the kids design their own education. Everything's there, and there's staff members that are there to help them. But ultimately, the education is that in those children's hands, but they're all responsible for their community. They all have to sign up for a chore. They're all part of their judicial community. They all have this judicial committee where if people get in trouble, there's no bystanders. They have to write each other up. There's, if you see something happen, you're just as guilty for if you don't say something. And so there's this, their rule book is so thick, but yet inside those rules, they have absolute freedom to be in. And, you know, my oldest daughter is planning a trip to California with a group right now. Like that's part of their school day is that, and they're selling spaghetti at lunch to raise money for, you know, so they all have these really neat things that they're able to make out of that. But also inside of that, because you have the staff members who are facilitating and you do have everybody's keeping an eye out for each other, but there's always going to be those people who are going to say, well, what, there's not a rule for this thing. Let's see what I can get away with. And so there was a group of boys that were watching some inappropriate videos at school and they got in big trouble for it. But the idea is that you're like, oh, that would never happen in a regular school, you know, like, cause it just seems so awful. Yeah. Like that would happen during the school day.
Right.
That doesn't happen in public schools or whatever. But, but the idea is that, and I was talking about this, that yes, it is disconcerting or whatever. But the idea is that, but if they were at a regular school, I would rather them be here where I know what's expected of them and I know what the rules are and I know the freedoms they have can be conducive for good and for evil, basically. Yeah. But that if I sent them away to another school, that I would have this false sense of security that they wouldn't be getting into other things. Like just because they wouldn't be watching whatever, you know, they're going to find other things. There's always going to be those things out there. And so that I actually feel a lot better about my children's well-being, where they are, where they can get into that kind of stuff, but because I know it, I'm acutely aware of all the bad choices they could, could make, you know, whereas I might feel a little like, oh yeah, they're good. They're all in their little structured environment. And we know, I mean, we've all been through life. We all know that if we want to do something, we're going to figure out a way to do it. So it's just, I don't like the things that, you know, of course the kids aren't the kids, but I mean, but actually there's a firm sense of justice. You know, those kids got suspended and, you know, there's not this, oh, you can just do whatever you want to do. There's definitely expectations, but you do run that risk that there's going to be the kids that are going to,
realizing that, you know, basically, yeah, not hiding from risk, but recognizing that you have to build strong senses of responsibility to deal with risk, you know, that I think that's the bigger and more important lesson, right? And and I have to assume that that's why, you know, God created the world the way it is, right? That there is so much freedom to do bad things. But you're not trying to create a situation for your kids where nothing can ever go wrong, because that's not, you're not actually raising them for that environment. You're raising them for them being adults, right? You're raising them because you want them to be responsible adults at some point, and they're not going to live in a classroom forever. You can't just squeeze all the risk out of the environment and be okay with it. And similarly, I would assume that with the amount of open-ended risk we have available to us as human beings, that it's at least partially because, we have to grow up. We have to learn to deal with this kind of responsibility because we're not just going to be static in a given sort of community or given sort of society forever, that we actually have to rise to these challenges and figure out how to be responsible, creatures, you know?
Right. And the idea that pushing boundaries is inherently a bad thing is something that is deeply ingrained in much of our culture, I think. And mm-hmm. that's something that I think is why a lot of people kind of get very upset about different educational models. But yeah. the idea is that, oh, those boys that got in trouble, they were pushing boundaries. Well, my daughter's also pushing boundaries by helping yeah. orchestrate a trip to California. You know, yeah. like that's, and there's always going to be those kids who don't want to do that. And for them, hey, they mm-hmm. can have science class and math class and do everything the way they need to do things. But there's always going to be those kids that are going to say, hey, how far can I take this? How far can I work within the boundaries of our system? And it's going to manifest in different ways according yeah. to different personalities. And some kids are going to say, you know, can I light a fire in the backyard? Or yeah, some yeah. kids, because that happened too. But there's always going to be the other kids. I mean, and it's sometimes those same kids who are lighting fires and bringing inappropriate movies to school are also sometimes the kids who are creating great innovations and yeah. that are helping a lot of people. It goes both ways. And it reminds me of like 20% time at Google, yeah. you know, oh no, 20%, that's a huge chunk. They're going to pay for those people to just, what if they just slack off? What if they take a nap? They can do whatever they want, really, you know? And yet we've seen all these really, really interesting, life-changing mm-hmm. innovations come out of that 20% time that people were willing to take a risk on. And I think that that's yeah. that idea that yes, yes, a large chunk of life is just maintaining it and doing your chores and brushing your teeth and whatever the 80% time at Google is, you know, that's it. You know, it's like any big event you plan, like a wedding or something. It's like months and months and months, and then it's over in 10 minutes, yeah. you know, like that's, but it all, you know, so yeah. And that's something that it took me a long time to make any peace with that. I hated the idea that we had to maintain life. And that was so much of life. I was mad at God for a long time yeah. that sleep was necessary. Yeah. I mean, I was literally mad. It made me so angry.
Yeah.
Like, I'm like, what? You could have done anything else. And yet, and so of course now I get it. I get the whole idea of rest and regeneration and all that stuff, you know, it makes sense. But yeah, that as long as we're not the whole, but I do think a large chunk of religion is about we're just maintaining this thing.
Yeah.
And that's it. Maintain this thing until you die, the end. And I'm just, and then we're all going to be the same. That's the end result. We're all going to go to heaven and then we're all, you know, heavenly robots. And,
right.
Yeah. And I'm just, there's something that's not satisfying about that to me. And not comforting to me, and not, I reject it.
Well, yeah, what you get in Christianity, which you get with a lot of different religious traditions, is you get a kind of revolutionary character right at the very beginning who, you know, basically kind of throws open the doors on all kinds of new disruptive ideas and, you know, and so forth. And then over time, people have to figure out, well, how do we maintain this? You know, like, how do we can't stay kind of, you know, in that happy, highly caffeinated state forever. We've got to also sleep and recharge. And that's where you get orthodoxy from. Basically, it's like, what, you know, what are the things we need to do to kind of maintain this so that we can do it over the long term? And so, you get, you know, like the Greek Orthodox. I'm thinking of Jesus coming along and saying, you know, all foods are clean. And so for the Jews, they had this, you know, a very strict idea of what was okay to eat, what was not okay to eat. And Jesus basically says, throw out the rule book. All foods are clean, right? And then within a few centuries, you get the Greek Orthodox Church, which has a fasting schedule of 200 something days per year of various things that you can and can't eat, right? And so but the thing is that that might not be just a pure contradiction. It might just be that, you can throw out the rule book, but then sometimes you have to figure out how to, you know, figure out a sustainable pace, basically.
Right. And I'm definitely learning the hard way and late in life about having the importance of routine and just taking that idea. And I ran from it for a long time because of the idea that, like I mentioned, I was such a jerk when I tried to follow the rules to such a T. And I was like, I don't want to be that person. So I did associate that hyperstructure with a type of person I didn't want to be. And I had to, you know, I did run away from that for a long time. And now I'm seeing, you know, well, it's not, you know, there are definitely things that contributed to my jerkiness that had nothing to do with church doctrine.
Right.
So, but definitely influenced it. So, but you know, just working on that and deciding and realizing what are the best, how to be efficient with my stasis, I guess, is another thing. 'Cause rest isn't just rest. You have to have high quality rest in order to be the best, do the best thing. So if I want to optimize my 20% time, then my 80% has to be really, really, has to be hyper-structured, which it seems so counterintuitive. And yet that is what I've observed. The best systems, the things that I respect the most and the things that just seem to persevere, do function that way. Like my kids' school, I mean, super heavy rule book. And every day there is a structure, you know, you have JC and we open the doors at this time and we close the doors at this time and everybody has to do a chore. But yet the rest of the day, hey, it's all yours and do what you want to do. And right now I'm kind of in this 100% time where everything's just kind of exploded and trying to figure out what I want things to be, you know, I want to be able to be making new things and building new worlds, but at the same time I have to have to maintain my tools. So
yeah. Well, the idea of, you know, optimizing and having a very strict process around some areas so that you can have this kind of free flow and creativity in other areas. You know, I try to do the Steve Jobs thing, which is to wear the same thing every day. Mm-hmm. And the theory, I think Mark Zuckerberg does this. And the theory is that if you don't have to make choices about what you wear, then all that energy is freed up for other things, right?
Right.
And, you know, that typically works better for certain kinds of people than other kinds of people. But you know, so I love that idea, like to look like a cartoon character with the same outfit every day. And to just know, you know, to not even have to think about what that looks like. And then to be able to take all of, you know, whatever kind of energy might be there, I don't know, and pour that into totally different and unique ways of spending my time.
Right. Sorry. Can you hear that? I'm sorry. Sorry. Could you hear what was going on? Or were you?
No, I don't think so.
Okay, sorry. I got a Skype call in the middle. It was super loud.
Oh, really?
Yeah, but it shouldn't do that. But anyway, but you couldn't hear it at all.
Nope.
So I could have just ignored it and nobody would have known.
Nobody would have known.
So, sorry. What was the last thing you said? Sorry, I got a little distracted. I'm so sorry. It was so loud.
just that idea of, yes, you know, taking your 80% time, you know, making, basically living in a really kind of structured way, just so you don't have to think about it, so you can have that freedom. And I think maybe that applies to a lot of things in terms of, yeah, maybe we do all have to follow a certain strict set of rules so that we can be, you know, have this free will and that we can be individuals in so many other ways. you know, so maybe the boundaries that we should strive for are not a set of boundaries where we have defined everything about our life and our world, but the set of boundaries that basically are minimum operating conditions for just kind of an open-ended future.
Right. And that's going to help us not only be able to interact with other people who have different ideas, but when we're talking about, you know, robots that are going to be able to think on their own or whatever, yeah, or deep space exploration and aliens and things like that, like what does that mean? And I think a big part of the fear that surrounds that is this idea, especially in Christian circles, and I've had so many conversations about this, where the fear is these aliens aren't playing by our rules, mm-hmm, and that when there's this idea, and especially a lot of people who do subscribe to predestination and Calvinism, it comes with the idea of the total depravity, that you are a deeply, deeply broken, horrible, yeah, horrible person. You know, all humanity is evil. And yet Christ is what fixes that. What happens if these aliens out here are also deeply, deeply broken, but they don't have Christ, then what do you do? And so that's where you see these war. I mean, we have the culture wars here in our own country with our only own, you know, our own countrymen. And there could be no other differences between us yet, except for how we view what happens to us after we die, you know, but there's so, I mean, just families being torn apart over these things yet. So if that in and of itself is such a big deal, what happens when you're introducing just the very idea of somebody who's playing by rules that you can't understand at all and maybe never will be able to understand? What is that? I mean, that would be terrifying. That would upset everything. And to the extent, I think I've even mentioned this before, I forget what things I've said and haven't said, I need to keep a list, but the idea that I was having a conversation once about the moons of Europa, I mean, sorry, not the moons of Europa. Europa itself probably has an ocean underneath its surface, and that ocean very well could sustain life and maybe has, you know, whatever, there might be something down there. And I was talking to this person and they said, oh, if that's true, then I can't believe in God anymore.
Hmm.
And I, you know, it was a family member. So of course we got in a big fight because, you know, because with that idea, like, excuse me, you know, you said, oh, the more interactions you have with somebody, but there's also the more interactions you have with somebody, the more comfortable you are with them. And the more like the likelihood that you are going to, I don't know, it goes both ways.
Yeah.
Like you do have expectations and you want to get along, but at the same time, it's so important that you get along that you end up and that you're all on the same page that you fight for what that page looks like. So yeah, we ended up, it was like 3 years ago, but yes. And it was fun. I mean, we just got to a point where we're like, we just can't talk about these things anymore. And you know, we just don't, but it was something that I just, to hang a linchpin on, I couldn't fathom like that, why God would be any different.
Yeah.
And he couldn't fathom why, you know, it blew up. Like it was over something that you would never, anticipate.
That's a great thing to have an argument about though. Like it. That's actually, you know, a friend of mine and I were talking about, some of this, yesterday, in terms of, you know, C.S. Lewis wrote a science fiction trilogy, where, the idea is God creates, human beings all over the place and all over the universe. And they're not exactly human beings. They're whatever they are, they're creatures, but, you know, and engages in a similar process with them. And that wasn't a problem for C.S. Lewis because C.S. Lewis has this expansive Christian imagination that can wrap into it, you know, centaurs and dwarves and you know, all kinds of things with no problem. And that's very different than the kind of perspective, which is like, oh, you know, we have to live in this bubble world where nothing of significance is happening outside of our atmosphere.
Right. And that's what made me so mad, because it's so funny you bring up that book, because I brought up that trilogy in that conversation, and I pulled it off his shelf and I was like, look, and I was like, what happened to you? You used to be full of imagination, you know, like, anyway, yeah. So it was, and of course he was like, what happened to you? You used to stand for something, and, you know, so it was so great. It was a horrible fight, but it was also so great.
Like, I love it.
It was like something, I mean, it was like out of a movie or something. It would be so great. Like, who fights over the oceans on Europa? Like, who does? Just my family.
I love it. It's
cool.
It's great. Okay, well, Amy, speaking of boundaries and limits and all that, I think you've got a deadline, so I want to let you off so you can go and have your 20% time and create things and have free will and choices and make an open-ended future.
All right, good wrap up there.
All right. I'll talk to you later. Hey folks, Micah here. Thanks so much for listening. Remember to go to Christianity.plus. That's the web address, Christianity.plus, to subscribe via email or iTunes to the podcast and to see show notes and links for this episode. Thanks again, and we'll see you next time.